Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Break out the hoe, the spade, the watering can. Spring gardening is underway, and whether you have a yard full of plants or some raised beds in the side yard, a window box, some potted plants on an apartment deck, you want that cultivated patch to look its best and produce, particularly if you're growing vegetables. That can be daunting, particularly for those without a green thumb. But by asking and getting answers to a few gardening questions, your thumb may turn green. So let's get to it. We've invited several experts to help you make your gardening efforts more successful. Aaron Hostetler is a local gardener and owner of The Patio Farmer, specializing in edible installations for small spaces. Cherie Jazar is also a local gardener and owner of Deep Roots CPS Farm. That's a service specializing in the creation of sustainable agriculture in urban spaces. And Mary Roberts is owner of Windcrest Farms in Monroe, a family farm with 14 acres and greenhouses. Thanks for being here, everybody. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Aaron, I'm going to start with you because we're well into spring. Before I start, excuse me, gardening is America's biggest hobby. It grew even larger during and after the pandemic. So if you have questions that you need answered, you can email them to us right now at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can tweet us, I think, at Charlotte Talks. Trust the email. We don't know anything about X. Okay, so we're well into spring, Aaron. The temperatures have really already climbed into the upper 80s. We'll be there again today. Is it too late to get started on spring or summer gardening? And if not, where should you start right now?
Yeah, well, it's definitely not too late. One of the beautiful things about growing food here in the Charlotte area is that there's always something that we can be planting, growing, harvesting throughout the year, even through the winter and the cooler months. But right now is a great time to be planting your tomatoes, your cucumbers, squash, eggplant, peppers, okra, anything that produces a flower and then a fruit from that flower is great for the warmer months, which we are most definitely in now. So that would be a great place to start.
And Mary, you're more than a gardener. You have a farm. You have many acres out there in Rowett Windcrest Farms. It's hard work, as you well know. I'm not telling anything you don't know. You also have greenhouses, and you have to prepare the soil. You have to plant. You have to water. You have to fertilize. You got to tend the plants, harvest the plants at some point, or if they're flowers, you've got to take them out, put new ones in. Why, then, is this such an attractive activity for so many people?
You know, I personally was born this way. When I was 2 years old in East Texas, my grandmother would give me a tin can and a spoon and just say, you can dig in the dirt all you want, just don't dig up the pansies. So it is something that has been my goal. A big corporate detour, but I've been on this property for 48 years. And when the opportunity presented itself to be a farmer and a greenhouse worker full time, I took it. And that was 20 years ago. And now we not only produce food, flowers, spices, herbs, but we grow, the majority of our business is growing plants for home gardeners. We were one of the first USDA certified organic farms in the Southeast. As far as I know right now, we're the longest standing certified farm in the Charlotte metro area. So we have a unique spin on growing plants and food, and it's a passion. I mean, I'm living the dream, as they say.
And Cherie, you have a kind of a unique twist on what you do because you specialize in the development of and the maintenance of urban gardens. Are most people gardening now to make their environment better, or with inflation and the rising cost of groceries, Are they gardening to grow food to sustain themselves, or at least minimize some of the grocery bill?
Well, you know, that's a great point. I think there are two main reasons why people are growing. The first is, yes, we want to have our own food, a source of food for our family. That's why we started our urban farm, is because we wanted to have fresh, local, healthy, organic food for our family. And then the other one is, you know, gardening. I think all the guests here would agree is such a therapeutic thing. You know, it is a way to relieve stress. It's a great way to recreate, not only with yourself, but with your family. So, you know, growing food is something that we believe in. There are many areas in Charlotte that don't have access to healthy food. And so that's why we started our farm and help others to do the same, to grow food or have some level of edible landscape. But the recreation part is definitely a part of gardening.
Yeah, a lot of people turned to this for the first time, gardening for the first time during the pandemic, I think because they were alone and this was a way to exorcise the demons, to help their mental health. And then with the rising cost of food, growing your own fruits and vegetables, I suppose, can help a lot, particularly if you're into canning and you have a bumper crop in the summertime. You can live on that or at least use it through most of the year. Tell me about urban farming, though, because do you pick the locations or do people come to you and say, we have this plot of land in our community, in our neighborhood, we'd like some help in making this work as a food production source? How does it work?
So that's exactly right. So perhaps it's a homeowner who has a particularly large backyard. It could be a church that has an area on their property that is just grassy that they'd like to install some raised beds. It could also be, we do have partnerships with local restaurants who just want to install maybe culinary herbs so that they can use them fresh for their restaurant. So urban farming is just basically growing in a very dense area in the city. So perhaps it's raised beds, perhaps it's creating a market style garden or farm. We have a 7-acre farm located in Northwest Charlotte, and on our 7-acre farm, which is in terms of farming is relatively small. There are hundreds of acres of farms in our region and in our state, but we have a 7-acre farm. We raise goats. We raise about 100 laying hens for eggs. We also raise broiler chickens, meat chickens. We also have 5 beehives where we have fresh honey that we extract in the spring and fall. And through all of that, we think we're creating this ecosystem that is not only good for our city, but that we can take what we produce and share it or sell it at market for our community to have a local source of healthy food.
I want to come back to the goats in a minute or two. Each of you has tackled different aspects of cultivation here. Aaron, your business, the patio farmer, focuses on growing things in small spaces, including food, because you can grow cucumbers on a balcony in an apartment building if you want to. But given the explosion of apartments in this region, is this something that is taking off? Are there lots of people with potted tomato plants and window boxes full of zucchini?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of my clients do have fairly small spaces. A lot of them are growing in containers or small planters. I do have, you know, maybe a little over half of my clients who have maybe a raised bed or a larger space as well. But, you know, back to the point of just the recreational aspect of growing food, and especially when you live in an apartment, maybe you don't have a whole lot of green space around you, being able to invite a cucumber plant or a tomato to live on your balcony in a medium to large size pot in a sunny, hopefully, fingers crossed, sunny corner of your balcony. The sun can be a challenge when you're growing in an apartment. But, you know, if you have 6+ hours of sun and enough room for a decent sized pot, there are, the possibilities are endless, really. Yeah.
And
For
Mary,
what you can grow.
you have a farm and greenhouses, and you've already talked a little bit about what you do. You not only produce plants and food, you produce plants that people can buy. You also conduct classes so that people can learn how to do a lot of this by themselves. And they come to you, as I said, to buy plants, also seeds. What's in most demand? Where would you steer beginners who really have never tried gardening, but they see everybody else doing it, so let's get into the game. Where would they start?
Well, they would start by talking to somebody like Cherie or Aaron or myself about what their space is, what their environment is, how much sun do they get, what's their access to water, what's their favorite vegetable to eat. There's lots of different questions and lots of experts we're lucky enough to have in the Charlotte area as a good place to start. Our specialty is growing lots of different plants to help folks get started. For instance, Aaron was talking about small spaces. So some of the plants that we offer gardeners are dwarf tomatoes or patio cucumbers. So plants that are bred to fit in small spaces. And then for the experienced gardener, or as you're growing in your journey, we have this year we offered 48 different varieties of tomatoes for the home gardener. We had 25 different varieties of peppers. So we're offering varieties that you aren't going to find somewhere else. And that's kind of our claim to fame. And when you come to the farm, what we offer you to plant at your own space, we're actually growing here. So somebody can say, well, how big is this going to be? What is this going to look like? And we can take them right onto the farm and say, well, there it is, full grown. Or here's the space that it's happy and it's thriving in. We offer companion plants. So, and not just the vegetables, but to keep the pests away, maybe you want to plant a borage with that tomato plant to repel the tomato hornworm. Or you want to plant a basil with that tomato plant because, there is an Italian dinner in your future. So, starting the very beginner, I would try to connect with some of these great resources that we have in Charlotte that know about the climate in this area, have growing experience in this area. And all of them are connected with the best suppliers, the local suppliers in the Charlotte metro area. So I have a hashtag, skip the big box store. I'm going to use that one now because you can come to local experts and get the best start.
Only have about a minute left here, Cherie, but I know people get pets because they want a pet, but then they realize I got to take care of this pet. And the same thing is true with gardens. You start a garden, and depending on how much land you have cultivated, from a flower pot to a whole backyard, it takes time. How much time does it take the average person in about 30 seconds or less? That's the time you have.
How much time does it take for you to cultivate a garden?
Yeah, and
Wow.
take care of it. Every week.
Yeah, it depends on what you're growing. It actually does. But it could take as little, I think, as maybe twice a week, maybe a couple of hours a week, or as long, if you have a big garden like ours, every single day for about 6 hours a day. So it just depends.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back with more about spring and summer gardening and things you need to know. And we'll get some of your listener questions answered as well in a moment in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about spring and summer gardening with Aaron Hostetler, local gardener and owner of The Patio Farmer. Cherie Jazar is also a local gardener, owner of Deep Roots CPS Farms. And Mary Roberts is the owner of Windcrest Farms and Greenhouses out in Monroe. If you have gardening questions of your own, you can send them to us now at charlottetalks@wfae.org. That's our email address, or you can X them to us at Charlotte Talks. I know, Cherie, you wanted to follow up on where people can go to learn to garden or start their own gardening enterprise. Fill us in.
Yeah. So, we're considered beginning farmers or beginning gardeners by the USDA definition. That's anybody that's been farming for less than 10 years. So, the surprising thing about gardening, you garden for a season and you learn lessons, but the season only comes around once a year. So it takes a long time to really cultivate the skill. So we started a growers network of local growers, people who are growing flowers, growing vegetables, raising backyard chickens, from novice all the way up to professional experienced farmers. And we meet on a monthly basis and we share information and resources and share stories of success and failures. And we give tips. So, if anybody's interested in joining that network, you can go to our Facebook page send me a message and I'll connect you with our network. And it's a regional connection of growers.
Let me share a couple of questions that have come in from listeners. This one on Facebook: is milkweed invasive? It's taking over my garden bed. How can I control it? Who would like to chime in on that? Erin looks like it looks like you do or you don't. I'm not sure that you want to comment, but you're looking with anticipation. So I'll start with you, and if you don't want to answer it, that's fine.
I was actually going to nudge Mary because okay. I know that Mary
okay,
I know
Mary.
That Mary has done a lot of milkweed growing.
Okay, Mary, go ahead.
Okay. The old saying of one man's trash is another man's treasure. It's a kind of the same way with milkweed. I mean, we love milkweed because it is supporting the butterflies,
right?
And as well as other beneficial insects. And about 97% of the insects that we have in the garden are actually beneficial. There's just about 3% that are the bad guys. And when folks use a broad spectrum insecticide, they're actually wiping out more of the good guys than the bad guys. So first and foremost, I like milkweed because it is supporting that healthy ecosystem. Now, that being said, I have 14 acres, so I can let it go crazy. But, in a small area, now that beneficial plant can become invasive. But it's a matter of cultivation. A weed is invasive. There's lots of plants that are, and they say that a weed is that plant that's just growing where it's not wanted. It's not necessarily a weed, but it's in the wrong place. So as gardeners, that's what we learn, how to manage those weeds, whether it is going out in the evening and pulling them up out of the ground, which is for me very meditative, mulching to smother them out, cultivating with some kind of hand tool. Yeah, that's my answer. Erin,
okay.
chip in.
So Erin, unless you have, go ahead, you have more to add to that? Okay, if you don't, what are the basics that you need to be a successful patio gardener? I mean, what are the very basic things you need to start, aside from a flower pot?
Right. Yeah, I mean, first thing that I always look at when I'm meeting with a new client doing a consultation in their space is sunlight. You know, I pull up the compass on my phone. All smartphones have a compass app or the ability to have a compass on them. And I pull that up and I immediately assess for sunlight. I find where south is and orient myself in their space for wherever is south facing. That's our most direct sunlight. And oftentimes the sun, our access to sun is something that's can be a little bit more challenging to change, right? So we have to at times work with what we have in our space. But you really want to put all of your edible plants in the space that gets the most sun. And then, you know, it's thinking about the space that you have and what kind of environment are you going to be growing food? Are you confined to pots and containers? And I say confined, but there's still plenty of things that you can grow in pots and containers. Or
are there things that you should avoid growing in pots or containers? For instance, when people grow zucchini, they tend to have these bumper crops. They grow so much that they can't give it away. And in a small space like an apartment balcony or a small enclosed patio, would that be too much? Are there things you should stay away from?
I would say no, okay. But there is the right combination of what you want to be growing and the size container that you give it and how much space you put in between your plants. I mean, the bigger the plant, the more space. And it's, you know, I feel like when you go to plant something or you're using a seed, you know, you pop it in the soil and you're like, oh, you're so sweet and small and you're not going to get that big, right? Let me put someone else right next to you. And then give it 4 to 6 weeks and you have a massive edible jungle that is beautiful, but maybe a little out of hand. So I think it's really about finding the right size container and size space for the things that you want to grow. But a zucchini grows beautifully in a pot.
And when you have more space, like as you would in an urban garden setting, Cherie, what's the rule of thumb? How many different things should you plant depending upon the space that you have? How do you determine that given the space that you have? Is it just simply based on, I love tomatoes, so I'm going to grow tomatoes, or I'm going to grow a variety of things because why not? Are there any rules to that?
Well, I think if you're a beginner, the first rule should be identifying what you, if you're going to grow produce or vegetables, what do you want to eat? What do you like to eat? Because a lot of times, if you start deciding I'm going to grow a variety of things and then you don't want to eat it, you're not going to want to maintain it and you're definitely not going to harvest it. And if you don't maintain it, it may not even get to harvest. So you might actually feel like a failure. So the first rule is identifying the things that you like. If you like tomatoes, grow tomatoes. And once you start growing the tomatoes, then you're going to realize or learn about, you know, companion planting and that you may need some marigolds in close proximity to your tomatoes to attract the pollinators. So you might actually start growing some flowers and see that you like that. So, you know, that's the first thing, but it could, just like Aaron say, depend on your spacing. You can grow a whole lot of things. The idea of growing is sort of personal in a sense of what is it that you want to cultivate. If you want to have salsa during the summer, you're going to plant some onions, you're going to plant tomatoes, cilantro, and some basil, right? You could start there in the idea. If you want to do tomato sauce, you're probably going to be planting some oregano along with the other things that I just mentioned. You need to start what you actually want to consume.
Mary, no matter how much space you have or how little space you have, I would think it comes down to some planning in advance in terms of what you want to plant, how much you want to plant, and how you want to lay it out. Would that be accurate? And are there any rules or any recommendations that you would have for people?
Well, our rule and recommendations is to look at nature and see how she does it, because she's been doing it from the beginning. And it's not necessarily in rows, neat little rows of one type of thing and then another row of something else. As Cherie was mentioning, you can mix these things together based on what you want to grow. And actually, everything that goes into salsa, those plants are wonderful companion plants in the garden when you plant them. They work together to not only repel insects, but also to enrich the soil, because these plants are talking to each other through the soil and exchanging nutrients and information, actually. Soil health is a subject we could talk about for a long time. But the there is no rules except that sunlight, as Aaron had talked about, water, and as Cherie mentioned, plant what you like, because if you don't like it, you won't take care of it and you won't be successful. So good advice.
Aaron, the term companion plant has come up a number of times already in this conversation. Let's define that and talk about that, because the idea here is that these plants complement each other, if correct me if I'm wrong, and that they can act as natural pest control devices. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So companion planting is the practice of placing one friend or plant next to another in your growing space. And we can practice companion planting to achieve one, two, or three of the following goals. It can either help to deter something from visiting our space, potentially like a bunny or a squirrel or a deer. It can improve your soil chemistry, which we have touched on, and it can attract pollinators to your space. And most of our things, you know, I mentioned earlier that grow this time of year are flowers that produce fruit. So a flower requires pollination in order to produce the fruit that we eat. So great companion plants are anything that flowers is going to help bring in pollinators. Marigolds in particular are a great companion plant for a lot of our summer vegetables because they are flowers, so they bring in the pollinators. They also have a fairly strong scent to them, which is generally speaking off-putting to deer and squirrels, bunnies, chipmunks. But even things like onions, like I love using green onion and planting almost a border of green onion around my plants. Onions and other strong scented herbs, rosemary, mint in a pot, always in a pot. It's a great.
Why in a pot? Always in a pot. And that was that, oh. And what you mean by that is never in the ground. Why?
Correct. Mint is one of our most determined edible plants. It loves to thrive and it doesn't need a whole lot to do so. It's very resilient. It spreads easily and it's hard to remove. So
let's get to some more listener questions. I started gardening, this listener says, in raised beds during the pandemic since we really couldn't go anywhere. And now I have cherry tomatoes and tomatillos. It's so exciting. I want to expand my beds, but this is my question. Would it be dangerous to plant a garden on top of septic lines that are currently failing, allowing gray water to pool in my yard, lines that I have no remedy to fix, sadly? I'm not sure which one of you has any expertise in that area. Maybe none, but go ahead, Mary.
I would not recommend it at all. When you think about the products that we use to clean our home, or even personal products that we might use, the plants are going to take those up, and then you would be consuming them.
But what's the difference between that and using an organic fertilizer, much of which is made from how can I say this on the radio? You
animal
know what I'm talking about.
Exactly. Animal byproducts. Okay. Because those animal byproducts have gone through a process of heat and aeration. Beneficial bacteria have broken those things down. Personally, here we do use a composted poultry manure that has gone through a very, very strict process and has been tested for pathogens, but mainly we rely on minerals, rock-based minerals and plant-based minerals that are certified organic to nourish our plants. And so this would open up a whole discussion about composting, which is a good discussion to have, but it's a totally different field. If you think about just cleaning products that you might use, unless you're strictly using something like vinegar or some natural, there's that water is carrying a lot of things. Pharmaceuticals, I would not recommend it. But the alternative is now to go to a container, the containerized gardening that isn't in contact with that gray water.
Okay. Email from Chris. I planted several tulip bulbs this past winter, and after they started to sprout, something has consistently eaten them and prevented them from blooming. They're in the front yard, and we do have wildlife, deer, rabbits, squirrels, chipmunks. What are some good recommendations for animal deterrence for future springs? Anybody have any ideas about that?
Tulips are not my area.
Okay, Cherie?
I was going to say it's probably the deer eating the tulip, but I would say the best deterrent, the only thing that you could really do that's healthy for our environment to keep animals from eating any of the things that you put in your garden is to put fencing or netting. So basically putting a barrier between what you're growing and the animal that will want to eat it. That's only the things that are above ground. Voles and moles will go below the soil surface and eat the roots. So you could try and put some sort of protected fencing that is deep down into in the soil. But the best thing, the healthiest thing for our environment is just to try to net it or fence the area. Yeah.
If you're going to go down to prevent voles and moles from getting to the roots, how deep do you have to go?
So in some of our areas that we grow artichoke plants, for some reason, they love to eat the roots of those. We go about 5 feet down, and that's wow. Way down. And in some areas they get through it, but yeah, you want to build some sort of protected barrier between your garden and the animals.
Cherie Jazar is the owner of Deep Root CPS Farms. Mary Roberts is with us. She's the owner of Windcrest Farms in Monroe, and Aaron Hostetler owns The Patio Farmer. We're going to come back and talk more about gardening and get some of your questions, including one about compost. Answer. We just talked about gray water. Let's talk about compost when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about spring and summer gardening, or year-round gardening for that matter, of whether you have a pot on a balcony in an apartment complex, or whether you have acres and acres of stuff that you want to do. You want to have a raised bed in the side garden, or you want to plant your front yard with 1,000 different perennials. Please don't. Erin Hostetler is with us. She is the local owner of The Patio Farmer. Mary Roberts owns Windcrest Farms in Monroe and greenhouses and specializes in all kinds of things, including organic gardening, which we'll talk about in a moment. And Cherie Jazar is the owner of Deep Roots CPS Farm. We have a listener question. And by the way, if you want your questions answered, you only have a couple minutes left, so get them in to charlottetalks@wfae.org or on Facebook or X at Charlotte Talks. Let's get this email answered. I like to try using Charlotte compost from a recycling center in both my lawn and my garden. How is the quality of city compost? In my raised bed, do I need to mix compost with other soil before adding to my bed, like peat moss? Who can take that?
I can start.
Okay, Erin. So
compost is a great thing to add to an existing soil before you plant for a season. If you're starting with fresh soil, most of our fresh store-bought soil comes already full of compost or full of nitrogen. And so, you know, you only need to refresh that organic matter when you're reusing a soil. And there's lots of different options of compost available. You can make your own, you can buy your own, you can get it from the city or the county, sorry. And I actually asked someone recently, I was presenting at an event in March, and there was someone from the county who knows, you know, is involved with the composting. And I was able to ask him the question of batch testing. So that's something that is done for a lot of different agricultural products, where, you know, you run an analysis for pH and different nutrients and things. And so I was curious and I asked, because I didn't know, but I asked, you know, does the county do batch testing on their compost before it goes out? And he said that, yes, every batch of compost that goes out from the county is, you know, is tested for quality and the right levels of pH, right, acidity and nutrients and things. So
yeah. Everything, I take it that everything starts with the soil, and we have a lot of clay soil in this area. And I've heard other agricultural extension agents suggest that you have the pH of the acidity of your soil tested to determine if you need to amend it or what might grow there naturally. But I keep seeing these commercials on television with Martha Stewart putting her hands into a bag of dirt and calling herself a dirt nerd. Is there a difference in the dirt that you buy at big box stores to do this? And if you know that you're going to want to grow a certain plant that maybe has deeper roots and you in clay soils, does the buying soil help in any way?
Well, Mary. I think it's really important to know where you're starting and know what your goal is. And in our area, you can have Carolina red clay that is mucky and thick, or in where our farm is located, which is about 7 miles from South Carolina, I actually have a sandy soil. Both have their pros and cons. With the sandy soil, I can go out after a rain and I can work it. I can put my hands in it. And in the summer, it doesn't bake hard as a rock. However, because of that soil structure, I have to pay more attention to watering and to nutrients because they leave that quicker. With the clay soil, it holds on to nutrients longer, but it also holds on to water longer, which can be a disadvantage, you know, if it's been raining. So it's really important to know where you're starting. And as you mentioned, testing the pH. So you're not just throwing bags of stuff onto a soil and creating an imbalance. So knowing where to start is very important. And then when you know that, what do you need to amend it with? If you're adjusting the pH, that's one component. If you're adjusting the texture, so I'm needing to add more water holding things to my sandy soil, where with the clay soil, I need to add something that loosens it, provides more drainage and more air. So one bag and one box does not fit all. And we have great resources in our extension agents that can help you, in the folks that are talking to you right now, because we've had a lot of experience seeing a lot of different soils. So when we get an inquiry about soil, it's really hard to know what advice to give until we have looked at it, felt it, and know what you want to grow.
Cherie, we've had an abundance of rain this spring. And although that may continue, we're also likely to have severe drying as we go through the summer in terms of drought. And because of the rain, however, some plants don't like wet feet. That's wet roots all the time. But mushrooms apparently do, and they're popping up everywhere. Are they good or bad if you're trying to grow other things in that area and you have mushrooms surrounding it? Do you know?
Interesting you mentioned mushrooms, because we actually grow mushrooms on our farm.
Now that's dangerous.
Well, the edible ones, like oyster mushrooms and lion's mane and such, and yeah, they're good to eat. But the mushrooms are actually can be a sign of good, wonderful soil health. So they're not, there's nothing to worry about when you see mushrooms popping up in your garden. Of course, having lots of moisture in your garden can be a problem. and you need to watch out for that. But I would say mushrooms would be anything that you should be overly concerned about at all.
Aaron, we have a question from a listener. Where is the best and cheapest way to get compost or manure? I suppose you could make your own compost. That would be the cheapest way, but do you have any other tips?
Yeah, I mean, making your own is fantastic. It's a great companion to growing food. It's a great way of reducing your household waste. And then, you know, the next cheapest option, I guess, would be through the county. But, you know, a little bit of compost goes a long way. And, you know, investing in high quality organic products, like Mary has a fantastic compost that she blends herself that's certified organic and it's plant-based, which I have three dogs and I personally appreciate the plant-based ingredients for many reasons, but because I'm a dog mom, that's one. So, you know, there's tons of different products out there, and I really do believe that you get out of the soil what you put into it. And sometimes the cheapest options that are available to us are not, you know, the best quality or not what's going to set us off on the right foot.
We talked about cicadas. This is a bumper crop year for cicadas, in this area. And, one of the things that, they attract or that seem to hang around the bottoms of trees waiting for the cicadas to emerge are copperheads. And somebody wants to know how you keep pests like copperheads out of your garden in general, and will they be more plentiful this year given the appearance of these 17-year cicadas looking for lunch?
Wow. I don't know if you guys have an answer for that, but there are copperheads in our area, but the most often seen snake that's on our farm or that we see in our urban spaces is the black rat snake. And it's a healthy thing for our environment. It helps take care of the rodents. But I do not know of a deterrent for copperheads.
Be on the lookout.
Our little, our dogs can help warn us maybe of that. I don't know.
A lot of people, I know also, they could, go ahead.
Sorry. Go ahead. I've also recommended there are like solar powered devices, and I can't speak to the efficacy of these, but I have had clients who have tried these. They're solar powered and they send out some kind of vibration frequency on the ground that snakes are sensitive to. So that could be something to look into. Also, black snakes eat some of our bad snakes. So if you see a black snake, just smile at it and thank it and give it its distance. Don't be mean to it.
A lot of people go and buy particularly flowers at these, and this is not pejorative, but these big box stores, and they'll look at the tag and it will say partial sun. Aaron, since you are the person with the compass, what does that mean, partial sun, in terms of where you can put that and have it thrive?
Yeah, great question. So I would say somewhere that gets dappled sunlight throughout the day. You know, you probably don't need 6 hours of direct sun for something that's partial sun or partial shade. But I would say somewhere where you're getting filtered sunlight, like through branches, you know, maybe it's cooler in the afternoon. But yeah, somewhere where you're getting that kind of happening.
And Mary, I know you have a dog in this race, but I'm still going to ask you this question, because when you go to a big box store, you unless you're starting from seed, you're buying plants that are outside on the rack, and you're taking them home and hoping that they will do well. How do you tell which plants on that rack have been taken care of and are in fact healthy and will remain healthy and not just die the day after you bring them home?
Well, you're going to look for plants that don't have obvious browning on the leaves. I always inspect any plant for insects that may be hiding underneath the leaf or crawling around on the soil. So you don't want to bring any pests or any plant that's currently under attack into your garden. The plant should look like it's shiny, not dull. It's got some presence to it. Now I know plenty of people who they are waiting to rescue plants from that clearance rack at the big box stores. And I mean, Facebook is full of, look at what I rescued, look what it looked like then, and look what it looks like now. So you can bring home a healthy plant and neglect it and it be dead the next day, even though it started out well. So you can't always blame the condition of the plant when you bring it home with its longevity.
So Cherie, it's time to talk about goats. You mentioned that you raise chickens, I guess hens to lay eggs. What'd you call the baking chickens?
Broiler chickens.
You raise goats. I understand the chickens, and I'm wondering if they're legal in the city. But what about the goats? Let's talk about the goats. Are they legal, number one? And number two, why?
Well, in our unified development ordinance, there's a land use code and a zoning code for a farm. And so if you have a farm, you can have goats. And if you have a farm, you can have chickens as well. And we raise goats because we do have a very diverse population in our region of people who have culturally significant diets that include goat meat.
And so you're raising these for food?
Oh, yes, most definitely. Yes. And we do have a number of farmers in our region who also raise goats for the goat milk. They make goat cheese, and they also make soaps out of the goat. We don't raise our goats for the milk, but we do raise them for meat, and we sell the meat at market.
Okay. At Windcrest Farms, Mary, you're focused on producing healthy plants. Many of them are USDA certified organic. What goes into organic agriculture? It's more than a label. I know that intellectually, but A, how do you trust that it really is organic if you go into the grocery store? And what difference does it make whether it really is or it really isn't?
Well, first of all, everything we do is USDA certified organic. We're not a split operation at all. And every year there is a lot of paperwork that we have to show that we are improving the soil. We're testing our water. We have to document from seed purchases all the way through sales. We have to maintain that line. There's no GMOs in any of our processes. We unfortunately have to pay a hefty fee for the privilege of doing that. But we have an annual inspection, and they can at any time take tissue culture or take plant material off the farm and have it tested for dozens and dozens and dozens of chemicals that are not allowed in the production. Usually small farms like ours do not go through all of that paperwork and expense for a certification. But the reason that we do is because we can't always talk directly to our end consumer. So that symbol, that USDA symbol, does carry some assurance that we aren't using things that would be prohibited in production. And that includes, as I said before, GMOs, chemicals, anything that we're using is close to the source of nature as possible. And we're audited for it and can be audited at any time. So it's a philosophy that we've believed in from the beginning, and one that we feel that is worthwhile.
I have a million more questions, including the impact of climate change as the climate's getting warmer and wetter and stormier, etc. But we don't have time to get into that. thought for another day. Aaron Hostetler, local gardener, owner of The Patio Farmer, Cherie Jazar, local gardener, owner of Deep Roots CPS Farms, and Mary Roberts, owner of Windcrest Farms in Monroe. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.